This is a paid commercial program and may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning. Welcome to For Your Benefit. This is Tammy Flanagan today. I'm here with you to talk about your money, your retirement. And to do that today, we have a special guest, Joe Sullender, is here to talk about financial planning. I'm here with the usual benefit information. It is tax season, so if you're looking for Bob Lyons, he is doing taxes from now until, I guess, April 18th. So I will be your host both today and next week as well. But we do have a good show planned for you today. As I said, the guest is Joe Sullender. He's here as certified financial planner, first vice president of investments with Wells Fargo Investors. Advisors, I should say.
Yeah.
I always think of investing. And he's also a 12-year veteran with NITP. So Joe and I piggyback each other, and most recently overseas. So we had an interesting trip.
Absolutely.
Welcome, Joe.
Welcome. Good morning.
Thanks for being here. And I know in these uncertain times, as federal employees, I guess, are happy to be back at work today, not knowing what was going to happen Friday when we all waited with bated breath, you know, to find out if the government was going to open this week or wasn't going to open this week. And now we know that we're
for now,
we're able to get paid again. And so that's one crisis averted. And we have all the troubles in the Middle East. We've got troubles with unemployment. We have all these things that could affect possibly our finances. But it seems like finances have been doing actually pretty well despite all the world tragedies that have been going on.
That's kind of the way it's worked over history if you look at it. The last 100 years, you can go back and look at the performance of the various markets, stocks, bonds, real estate, what have you. And it isn't like we haven't been dealing with events of this type over that period of time. And, you know, there's a famous saying that the market climbs a wall of worry. And I think that's kind of what's happening now, is that, you know, people are looking at, worrying about all these events, but the market is still performing because the economy is beginning to recover.
Yeah, Wall Street doesn't seem to care about personal tragedy as much as economic tragedy.
Yeah, right, exactly.
So even with Japan and everything devastating going on there, and the markets did take a little bit of a hit, I guess, in Japan, but not as much as maybe we might have worried about.
Well, that's been one of
about.
The positive things, is that the market's held up fairly well during additional adverse news.
Right, and I know even going back to like World War II, when we had the Great Depression, and it seemed like the war actually helped boost the economy in some respect because it created jobs and it caused rebuilding and things like that that were going on. So it seems like, you know, history tends to repeat itself with those kind of things.
Well, and the big key is to, I spend a lot of time talking about these sort of things, but I also try to take the focus off of the short term and get people to think more about their long-term goals. I mean, what happens? You think about 1973 to 74, where the Dow went from 1,000 to about 500. You know, if you retired in 1995, what the Dow did 73 and 74 is really of no consequence.
Really irrelevant.
So it's just a matter of making sure if you do have a long-term time frame, you keep that perspective. And if you don't have a long-term time frame, that you reduce your risk exposure.
Right. And that's why I get a lot of questions at the seminars, and I always say, well, Joe will be here tomorrow to talk about that. But they always lead it off by saying, well, given what's happening today, what do you think? Should I move everything, you know, with regard to the TSP to the G fund? And I'm like, well, my opinion is probably not, but, you know, Joe's going to talk about that tomorrow. And I think that leads back to the, you know, long-term investment horizon versus, you know, don't worry as much about what's happening in the current economy.
Well, and when you say given what's happening today, what people are doing is drawing long-term conclusions based on short-term phenomenon. If somebody had come up in a seminar in 1999, they would have said, given today, should I put everything in Cisco and Oracle and .com stocks?
Sure.
And that wouldn't have been the smartest move either. So
no.
I think a lot of the success that people have long-term in financial planning is their ability to absorb the short-term volatility, understand it, and not let it affect sound long-term planning.
Right. And so whenever somebody's trying to figure out, do I move money from C to G to F to S to I, you're not probably basing that advice on what's happening right now, but based on where they want to go or where they want to be in the future.
Mm-hmm.
So I notice when people ask you questions, you always try to turn it around as a goal. Like, what is your goal?
Sure.
What are you trying to do?
The kind of silly analogy I use all the time, it would be like walking into a Home Depot and saying, What's a good tool? Give me a tool. I need a tool for something. Yeah. Well, what are you trying to do exactly?
Yeah.
I mean, that CDs work well for certain things and stocks work well for other things. And so you have to start with what's the end you're trying to reach, and then figure out which tools will help you get there and make sure they're tools that you're comfortable with.
Right. In financial planning, our tools would be our retirement savings, our college savings, our mm-hmm. mortgages, our bank accounts, and we've got a lot of different places we can put money and like you said, different goals for what we're saving for.
Well, that's the hard part more than ever. I mean, there's just mutual funds alone is one category. There's over 15,000 of those. So, you know, a lot of people, the five funds in the TSP seems daunting. If you get out there in the investment world, there's a multitude of choices that can be overwhelming.
Right. And I guess going back to your Home Depot example, like when you're trying to buy a power washer, for instance, you know, if you're just trying to do your sidewalk, you don't need the same caliber as somebody who's got industrial
exactly.
strength needs.
Yep.
So you pick the one that's right for what you need.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, if anyone wants to join us today, we're going to try and take your phone calls. There was a few difficulties this morning, but I think maybe we can accept your calls. So we would welcome you to do that. Our phone number here on Monday morning from 10 o'clock to 11, almost 11 anyway, is 1-877-936-9333. That's 877-936-9333. And if you're listening to the archive version of the show and you want to send us an email, we'll be more than happy to respond to that as well. And that email address is For Your Benefit, the name of the show, For Your Benefit, at NITPINC.com. That's NITPINC.com. That's National Institute of Transition Planning, who is putting on this show for you this morning and every Monday morning. And as I said, we have Joe Sullender here with us today. We're talking about financial planning and retirement planning and setting goals for getting to those financial goals that you've set for yourself. So we're going to be talking in focus of federal employee benefits and maybe from all stages of career planning, maybe starting with the new employee all the way up to someone who is either planning for retirement or possibly even in retirement. And I guess each one of those stages are going to have different goals. Just like when I talk to employees about life insurance, and you know, many employees in the pre-retirement seminars are still holding the same amount of life insurance they bought when they were 22 years old and started a family and bought their first house, and they can't understand why it's gotten so expensive. Well, as you get older, I guess the risk is more on the side of the insurance company and less on yours, so maybe your needs for that insurance have changed over the years.
That's a great example about needs is that, you know, a lot of people that I meet with that are right on the verge of retirement or in retirement have all this life insurance and are continuing to pay the monthly premiums or annual premiums every single year, and they ask, should I keep it? Well, why do you have it is always the first question. And life insurance, I think, is one of the main investment vehicles that people have, and they're not really sure why, you know. And
because you're supposed to have it.
You should have it. And the thing is it's one thing when you're early in your career, you have children, you have you're earning income, and what if something happens to you? What would your family do without your income? But if you get into retirement and you have your retirement check coming in from the government and you've maybe even got a survivor benefit on it, a spousal annuity, then and the kids are grown and your house is, you know, either paid for or close to it, and you're living off of your investments, why do you need life insurance? Is sort of my question is, you know, if something were to happen, you have a retired couple and they're living off of TSP assets or IRA assets, that's money that still will be there.
You know, it would be there for both of you if you're married, so you wouldn't have to worry about losing that benefit if one of you died first.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I noticed that with a lot of people that we just do what we've always done and we don't really think about, you know, why we're doing it or the fact that, you know, maybe there's a better way to do it. Because even with FEGLI, our government life insurance, it's very good insurance. It's fairly priced for what it is, but it may not be the best insurance for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I left federal service back in 1988 was when my youngest son was born. So I'm thinking, well, my life insurance needs are probably have a 20-year horizon until Sean turned 20. So I went out in the private market and bought a 20-year level term policy and was amazed at how inexpensive
mm-hmm.
it was.
Sure.
you know, for $30 a month, I think I got $500,000 worth of coverage, and it stayed $30 a month for 20 years.
And it served its purpose because it went away 20 years later,
right.
And you don't need it.
I don't need it now. No, my husband's retiring. Yep.
A more expensive whole life or universal life policy you could have bought that you would still be paying for.
What is the role of a whole life policy in somebody's...
The difference between a whole... first of all, the basics of a whole life policy is a permanent life insurance policy. So your term policy, when it expired after 20 years, if you wanted to keep that insurance going, you would have had to renew it at a new 20-year term, and it would have been a lot more expensive.
Right.
And you get to a point where it gets so expensive that it doesn't even make sense to buy, or you don't qualify for it because of health reasons. So a lot of people like to buy whole life where they pay a lot more early on, and you keep a flat premium, usually, all throughout the policy, and the insurance is permanent. My question is, for the average federal employee, is just who I deal with, that's all my clients basically are in that world, then a lot of those people, when they retire and they have their government retirement and the health benefits through the government and their TSP, why do they really need to keep carrying this whole life policy? So I don't use it very much there. There are places where it is appropriate in estate planning, and you know, maybe somebody with a disabled child that needs to have insurance all along. I mean, there's it's kind of like the tool analogy again, that there's certain places where it makes sense, but unfortunately I feel like that's a tool that people buy more often than they need.
Than they really need it. They have it there and they never really use it or
right.
put it to the best use.
And you can always cancel it. I mean, you've got a whole life policy and you're hearing this and thinking, well, I don't need this anymore. I'll just cancel it. And there is cash value there. So it's not a lost cause.
Right.
Know? But again, that's
then you have to look at, I guess, taxes too.
Taxes,
because when
absolutely.
You cash in insurance, then you may have to pay some tax on the
possibly
profit if there is any.
If there is any.
And that's the other thing too. And insurance passes to the beneficiary, even Fegley.
Mm-hmm.
The beneficiary gets the insurance tax-free.
Mm-hmm.
So
absolutely.
When you do leave insurance to somebody, you know, there's no tax consequences, I guess, to that benefit that they receive. I was going to talk about some issues for new employees, even though the government is not hiring maybe as many people as they used to. There are still people getting federal jobs and getting hired as we speak. So the benefits they have available to them would include, you know, the FERS retirement benefit, which is a basic defined benefit.
Mm-hmm.
They also have, you know, they pay into Social Security like anybody else. And between those two benefits, that's going to create a foundation for their future retirement. But they're still going to need savings.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, as you and I know, the government offers the TSP as the way to save for retirement. Do you recommend that they should take full advantage of that or still
no
have
question.
Other investments?
Yeah, and if new federal employees come from the private sector, they probably had a 401k and are familiar with kind of how that works. The TSP, obviously simply the 401k for the government.
For the government.
And there's no question that that's going to be the key to take advantage of that. I mean, without question, I would put 5% in the TSP because that's the level that you get matching. And anytime that you get free money, the government will double your money. You sign, check that box, you know.
Yes.
But beyond that, I mean, it's I know it's difficult when you're first starting out, you know, to try to, you have bills to pay and you have other things that you want to do and trying to juggle all of this.
Mm-hmm.
But as much as somebody can put in the TSP, the better off they'll be early on because of all the years of compound interest.
Now, what if I am like a brand new younger employee and my goal is also not only to save for my retirement, but I want to save to buy a house?
Mm-hmm.
Would you recommend loading up my TSP with pre-tax money and borrowing for the down payment, or should I set aside a separate account to save?
Well, I wouldn't go lower than 5% in the
right.
TSP no matter what. So if you can do that and then you want to use extra cash to build up for a down payment, because one thing in this environment that with lending is things have changed quite a bit in the respect that you will need a down payment. I mean, you know, it's just, I know it seems crazy to say, but just 3 years ago, you didn't need a down payment. You didn't need anything. And so now, it may be a little more of a daunting task. So, and granted, if a young couple can borrow from a parent or something like that, that's fine. But if they're trying to do all of this and save on their own, then you're absolutely right that they'd have to juggle the TSP. And the thing when you're 25 years old is that if you put that 5% in the TSP, there is still time for you to save for retirement.
Right.
Now, just to expand on that, one thing I run across quite often is just the opposite. Is somebody is maxing out their TSP year in, year out. They come to meet with me. They're late 30s. They have two kids, let's say, 10 and 7, okay? And their TSP is six figures. They've done really well. It's very healthy. And you ask them, well, what do you have put away for your education savings? And they say, I haven't really done that yet. Well, then there's a situation, another place where it might be all right. So let's reduce the TSP for a little while so that we can have some money
put away for education. So I do think that a lot of times people just say, oh, I know you're going to say max out the TSP at all costs. Well, what you're pointing out about first-time home purchase or what I've added with education are things that you've got to consider as
well. Those are other goals people might have that not in addition to retirement planning. I think retirement planning is a lifelong road to ride, but, you know, educating your children, that might be another thing. And I've heard you talk to people about, you know, how do you plan to do that? Are you going to send them to a state school? Are you going to make them pay part of it? So you really have to think ahead as to what you really want for your kids and what you're willing to provide and what you can afford to provide in terms of that. And the same thing, I guess, goes with a house. You know, will there be a resource from either inheritance or parents, or right. are you on your own?
Yeah.
You got to save up yourself and maybe rent for a few extra years. So some early career goals could be three of those.
And early on, there's so much variability, too, because, I mean, it's easy to – somebody with a two-year-old really doesn't have any idea what college is going to cost, how long they're going to be there. I mean, there's no way to know that. And retirement works a lot like that, too. I mean, when am I going to retire? How much money am I going to need? There's a lot of variables. The younger you are, the more variation there is. So I kind of think it makes sense to piecemeal these goals and look at them all individually and just sort of see how on track you are for all of them and see where the extra funds need to go.
Right. And then one more question I had about new employees would be the idea of saving with after-tax dollars versus pre-tax. I know next year, probably later next year from what I've heard now, the Thrift Savings Plan is going to offer a Roth option where employees would be able to save part of their savings in the Thrift Plan, or all of it, I guess, if they wanted to, using after-tax money that would grow tax-free. Employees who want to do that now who meet certain income restrictions, who make lesser income, can save in a Roth IRA. So what do you think about Roth IRAs?
I think a good rule of thumb there is that the younger you are, I think it makes more sense because you would give up the tax deduction right away because you'd be putting after-tax dollars in. Well, the younger you are, the earlier you are in your career, the less the tax deduction really impacts you. I know it may feel like it has a major impact, but it's going to have a bigger impact later.
Right.
Particularly if you operate under the theory, which I kind of do, is that tax rates will rise. I mean, that's just, you know, this is my opinion, but I just kind of feel like that's we're at very, very low rates where we've been historically and around the world. So if you go operate under the assumption that, A, the accounts will grow, that, B, your tax rate will rise and your tax bracket will rise, then I like the idea of having a lot of money in a Roth IRA or Roth TSP as a tax-free shelter so I don't have to worry about
tax rates being higher and be able to take that money out tax-free. Plus, they're not subject to minimum distributions when you get older, and you can always have access to your contributions, right, in an IRA like that.
And inheritance, if you can. I know not many people early in their career are worried about leaving money behind, but when you get to that point, there's a lot of flexibility there, too.
More than there would be with traditional retirement savings plans. Okay, so that's the new employee who's planning for their future. What about the mid-career? You know, you were kind of alluding to someone in their 30s, maybe even someone in their 40s could still be certainly considered mid-career. They might still have 20 years ahead of them, working years, that they can accumulate wealth and plan properly. Should they do some type of a mid-career checkup at that point?
Yeah, I mean, that's where that story I told earlier, I think, is a good example of that. That's where you start to get a little more visualization of what your goals, what's going to happen, what you're expecting you're going to need. And that, I mean, frankly, that's just to step back for a second. That's really what the point of financial planning is it's very difficult to make a decision when you're 35 and comprehend how it's going to affect you when you're 65.
Right.
That's what financial planning really is to make sure that we don't wake up at 60 and want to retire and not have any money, you know. And so I think when you get to the mid-career is where you can start putting some things to paper a little bit. You know, 25, you just save as much as you can, take advantage of tax shelters, be aggressive, and we'll worry about the details later. You don't know all the details in your mid-career, but you might have a little bit of a better sense of, okay, I know now I have two children, that's it. You know, I'm expecting to go to state schools, or that's what I'm willing to pay for.
Right.
And I know when I retire, I'm going to leave the D.C. area and move to South Carolina. You know, you start to kind of have these.
Start visualizing the future.
And you can start running a little bit of math to figure out, am I really heading down the right path? And it's important to do this mid-career. I know you hear this with the seminars you do, just like I do, is that if we do we do mid-career seminars for a lot of various agencies all around the area, and one of the most common things that we hear in the pre-retirement seminars is man, I wish I'd had this in my mid-career so
that
I could do something.
The creation of the mid-career seminar came from pre-retirement seminars because that's all we did initially. You know, we thought people didn't need retirement planning until, you know, a year, within a year of their separation. And then they would say, well, this was great information, but like you said, wish we would have had it 20 years ago. We could have really done something with it and made different choices. So I think today it's pretty much common knowledge, especially with, when we have to save for retirement. It's not all about the pension, that we've got to plan ahead and think about
how
those
investments are. You see that more and more every year, I think, as the younger generations realize this is on them. I mean, it's not the kind of, not like the old CSRS or the old pensions that companies had where you just work there long enough and you get a nice
pension. You can be conservative and not have to worry. Because that's the thing that worries me now when I get to mid-career seminars and someone will say, well, you know what? I got burned in 2008, so I moved everything to the G fund and it's going to stay there. I just don't feel comfortable in equities, or they don't even know they're called equities. They'll say in the stock market. So how do you counsel someone like that?
To me, when I hear that story, it's almost like a, if you think of it like from a doctor point of view, it's sort of a symptom, and it's easy to make a diagnosis in that case, and that is an absence of a plan. I mean, a lot of people make those sort of decisions where they put their money into stocks. I mean, we see the numbers and can see the money where it flows, and people pour their money into stocks when it's at an absolute peak and then watch it go down, and then, oh, I got to get out of this. And then they get out and put their money in something else, and stocks start going up again, or that category. and we see this every single year. And a lot of that, I think, comes from just the absence of a plan. It's just sort of flying day by day, going, where should my money be today? And I think that's my biggest crusade when I do these seminars and working with the people I work with, is to try to give people that long-term perspective so that they don't fall prey to that. I mean, that's, I think, frankly, the biggest problem in money management today.
And I think to go along with that, an understanding of where their money's going. Like the lady, I think you and I both talked to a lady last week who said something about, when I put my money in the C fund or the S fund or the I fund, where is it going? I want to know who has my money and where did it go when it lost money? Like, she had no concept of
how it works.
How it works. And I think, you know, you're afraid of things you don't understand. And I think there's a lot of fear in the stock market because nobody really understands how it does work.
And it's easy for me to say, doing this for a living, it seems like, you know, but I totally can respect the fact that people look at these funds and just think, I don't know which one to do. And that's why a lot of the money resides in the G fund, because
it's like taking money to the bank. I put it in the bank. It's sitting there waiting for me. I can go back to the bank, get it out.
So I do think what you're saying is a great point in that before you make that step forward into putting money into, you know, into an allocated mix, or you really want to sit down and digest all of this, either with a planner or on your own, to do the research to know what you're investing in. Because I think a lot of, I mean, I spend a lot of time, again, with folks talking about understanding what they're in initially to keep it from ending badly. You know, I mean, 2 years later, if you don't understand what you're investing in and it goes down, you're going to be likely to just sell everything.
That's because you just don't understand where it went.
Exactly.
Who has my money?
Where did it go? They're taking my money. Sell it.
Well, this might be a good time also just to talk about if you feel like you need that extra second opinion, or you need some help with where do I put the money, or how do I understand where it's going, and, you know, am I doing the right thing to get to the goals that I'm setting for myself? How would someone go about hiring a financial planner? You know, not particularly you. I mean, that'd be great.
But in general. What I always tell people is however you find a financial advisor, whether one great way is to ask friends and family who they work with. I mean, that's a great endorsement when you have a friend that says, I've been working with them for 10 years. They listen to me. We meet once a year.
They speak English. I can talk to them.
It's a reasonable fee that they're charging. You know, you get all this out on the table. But however you come across that advisor, what I always recommend is that you set up an interview. And I don't mean let them interview you. I mean, you interview them and sit down and say, you know, here's kind of what I'm looking for, and find out about their practice. What's their area of expertise? You know, a lot of red flags pop up in those meetings. If they start pushing products on you in the first meeting, they're probably just a salesperson. They're not a financial advisor. And so you have to kind of sift through it a little bit until you find a synergy there, a person that you meet with. I mean that you click with. I tell a story all the time about the realtor that that I've worked with every time we've moved, where the first time we went to buy a house, we were buying a townhouse, just newly married, and we wanted a townhouse with no garage. And we spent two weekends riding around with a realtor looking at townhouses with garages. I mean, we had two beat-up cars. What do we need a garage for, you know? And she kept showing us things she wanted to sell us rather than listening to us.
What you wanted.
And our realtor that we are loyal to this day, we looked around at three houses. He took notes of what we liked and didn't like and then came back to us a week later or 2 weeks later and said, I found it.
Right. So
and
that's a good partnership.
He knew exactly what we were looking for, went and found it and delivered it to us. And to me, that's an invaluable service.
Yeah, when someone listened to you is
It seems is like it should be more often than it really is. But
And also someone who can anticipate what it is that you need to ask. Because sometimes you don't know what the questions are.
That's true, too.
What should I be asking?
And really, the way the advisory relationship works the best is when it's sort of like a long-term partnership mm-hmm. where you know when you pick up the phone, they understand your situation. They know your priorities. Mm-hmm. You know, they know what it is that you're looking for, and you do feel comfortable with the give and take of trust and asking questions.
Right. What is that? I know you have it behind your name. It's the initial CFP. Is that mm-hmm. a designation that you should look for when you're trying to hire an advisor? Is that some kind of symbol of like the Good Housekeeping seal?
It is a little bit. It does require, the CFP brand does require additional training, you mm-hmm. know, where you're held to a little bit different set of standards with the CFP board, that you are doing financial planning, that mm-hmm. you're not simply selling insurance policies or, right. you know, that you really are trying to focus on the client's needs and you've gone through a lot of training to figure out how to build financial plans and meet goals. I do say this, it's awful self-serving to me to say, hey, if they're not a CFP, good luck, you know. But you know, to be honest, there's a lot of financial planners out there doing great work that don't have this designation. Mm-hmm. But certainly if they have this designation,
you know,
it is a little
gone
bit of a stamp
the,
of approval on that front.
With what it takes to become that.
Yeah.
And how do they get a hold of you if somebody does want to talk to you specifically?
They can call me at, I'll give my number, 703-761-4776. And my email address, which actually is my name, which is joseph.sullender@wfargoadvisors.com. Or they can email the NITP email address. And
we'll certainly put them in touch with you.
They get forwarded, and I answer those questions all the time.
That's good. So we were talking about the mid-career and maybe at that point, you know, trying to set some goals or realign the goals you had. And I guess when you get to the point where you're actually setting the date for retirement, that's another time you want to relook at things and make sure you're on track. And mm-hmm. maybe you're not going to retire the date you picked, or maybe you'll find you're in better shape than you thought.
Yeah, I think mid-career, once a year, you kind of sit down and take a new look and see what's changed.
It becomes an ongoing thing.
But right there, you get right on the verge of retirement. I mean, it might be twice a year, might be even a little more than that. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, the one thing I've learned over the years I've been doing this is people think, you know, they come in and say, okay, I'm 58. I'm going to retire January 1st next year. And this is my plan. I'm moving to North Carolina, and here's the condo development I'm going to live in. And then you meet with them 6 months later, and something's changed. You know, I think I'm going to wait till July. Or, mm-hmm. you know, my husband's decided he's going to start his own business. Or, you know, we're not going to North Carolina. We're going to stay here and see. So I find talk about working with financial planners. I find that during that period of time, like 5 years up to retirement and the 5 years right after you retire, is the most intensive time to be really working on your plan.
It's a time in your life things are changing. Your kids might be getting married.
Definitely.
They might start having their own kids. Your parents are getting older. You might have caregiving needs. So I think it's a tumultuous time.
It's a transition.
Yeah, it's a transitional time for people. You know, they're not only planning for their own future and retirement, but they're also looking at what's happening within their families, mm-hmm. which can affect their financial plan.
Mm-hmm.
That's about the time maybe when people start thinking about long-term care insurance mm-hmm. around in their 50s, pre-retirement.
I think mid-50s is a good time to start thinking about it. The thing with long-term care insurance is whenever you sign up for it, you're going to pay whatever that premium is that you're quoted for the rest of your life, mm-hmm. you know, barring the insurance companies and whatever might happen. But you're pretty much quoted that and going to pay it for the rest of your life. So if I start a policy at 40, then it's going to be much less expensive than if I waited till 65, mm-hmm. but I'm going to pay for it for 25 extra years.
Right. So, you might have other things you're spending money on at 40 that you can do away with.
And
when
the
you're
risk
55.
Of needing long-term care from 40 to 55 on wood, it should be fairly minimal. But if you wait too long, then it becomes kind of too expensive for you to buy. So the reason why I say mid to late 50s is just when I look at the tables of, you know, I just take a company like a Genworth or John Hancock or whoever does these privately, and I look at what they would charge you if you started at 50, 51, 52. It really starts to get incrementally more expensive year after year in your mid-50s. Mm-hmm. And so insurance companies aren't dumb. They know what the risk is. That tells me here's where the risk begins, mm-hmm. you know, and that's why I kind of feel like that'd be the time to kind of look
at. So early to mid-50s would be a good time to start thinking.
I think so. I think the best time to pick to start a policy is the day before you need it.
The day before you need it.
That's write that down.
Perfect advice. Well, I know with the federal plan, they say that, you know, of course, they keep numbers and statistics. They said the average age for a federal employee, or I guess retiree as well, is 52 mm-hmm. to buy the federal long-term care plan. And my theory on that is that if I'm 52, my parents are at least 72, if not closer to 80. Mm-hmm. So I'm starting to see the effects of aging and long-term illnesses that I'm thinking, wait, 20, 30 years from now, that's going to be me. So who's going to take care of me, and how do I want that to happen differently than what's happening for my own parents?
And it's funny you said that, because the one metric that you can use to predict who's going to buy long-term care insurance is people that have had to take care of their parents.
Yep.
You know,
well, in the seminars, it's divided. We have two groups in this, and you probably see this too. You have the group of people who are caregivers, who've either taken care of parents or even spouses in some cases, who are saying, yeah, buy the long-term care insurance. You can't get enough of it. Then you have the other group of people who's never dealt with an aging parent whose grandparents lived to be 102. They're like, you don't need that stuff. You know,
although living to be 102 is probably more of a case.
More of a reason
to needing long-term
care. That you might need it. Well, before we get too late in the show, we did get some emails ahead of time, knowing that the famous Joe Sullivan Sullender was going to be on the show. So I wanted to go through a few of these and find out if we want to can discuss some of these and maybe provide some answers to the employees who wrote in. And here's the first one that came in from Anthony. He said, this one, again, is a hard one to answer, but let's give it a shot. He said, what rates of inflation will seniors experience to their cost of living in the decades following retirement? Mm-hmm. Are there calculators with expected inflation ranges? Well, you know, we're in a time of zero inflation right now, but we can look back on the time that my uncle's been retired 33 years, and he's seen double-digit inflation in his years of retirement. So it can go anywhere from 12% down to zero. Mm-hmm. So how would we predict the future?
Well, I didn't bring my crystal ball, so I don't know how we did. No, what I try to do with these sort of predictions is use historical data. Mm-hmm. And if we use as much data as we have at our disposal, we cover the Depression. We cover the 70s and 80s where you had the
high astronomical inflation.
We cover the period of time where there's almost zero inflation. And the historical rates run around 3.5%, you know, historically. Mm-hmm. So I usually use a number like that in my forecast. Yeah. And one thing just to add to this that I do just, again, financial planning is all about being on the safe side. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, the last thing we want to do is try to fudge these numbers so all the math works, fall just short and run out of money at 80.
That's right.
We want to make sure we're being conservative. So one thing that I do is use a lower inflation factor for the FERS or CSRS retirement annuity, just to be sure that if, for whatever reason, that doesn't keep up, and it has. It's been fairly close to inflation.
Right.
But I'll use a 2.5% and a 3.5%. You know, 2.5%
for the
annuity.
You're still good, even if inflation's not.
Even if this annuity doesn't quite keep up with it. Just, again, to be on the safe side.
Well, and that's not too far-fetched, because as we talk about things that Congress might have to change to reduce the federal budget, cost of living adjustments are always part of the conversation.
If they take, you know, a quarter point off of the cost of living adjustments, that's a lot of money in the government's pocket.
Over time, it can be a lot. This another part, well, not a part of the same question, but from the same emailer. He said that he reached CSRS. He's under the older retirement system. He reached eligibility, and he's planning for retirement. He said, please discuss considerations of spousal annuity versus term life insurance to provide income for my spouse. Mm-hmm. When she retired, we needed current income and decided on term life insurance sufficient to cover the mortgage and a small spousal annuity. So I guess his wife is already retired. She left him a small annuity, I guess, you know, who knows how much, and enough insurance, I guess, to pay off the house if something happened to her. So now it's his turn. He's retiring, and he doesn't know if he should leave her the maximum spousal benefit.
Well, she didn't do it for him, I wouldn't consider it at all. This is really a math question, I think, is that does it make sense to pay for the spousal annuity, which is, what, 10% of the annuity payment?
A little less than 10% because it lowers your taxable income.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, okay. So whatever that delta is, you know, how much term insurance would we have to buy to be able to replace it? Now, if you're comparing it to term insurance, that's a little bit different because spousal annuity doesn't go away.
Right.
Term insurance does. I mean, or at least it gets too expensive to keep.
Right.
So you are taking a little bit of risk that if I'm 60 when I retire and choose a 20-year term, term policy instead of the spousal annuity.
What do you have at 80?
What happens at 80? And you
watch who's pouring your coffee at 79 and a half.
That's a good point. Especially if you've done this to your wife when she didn't do it for you. But anyway, if you look at that math, I mean, that's what you have to kind of weigh, is what would the term insurance cost? Now, right. What a lot of people do, I think, erroneously, is they compare it to a whole life policy. Now that's a policy, yeah, that wouldn't go away. But what kind of, if you have a variable universal life policy, for instance, that's not guaranteed. There could be fluctuation in the cash value. So be careful when you're comparing apples to apples. The spousal annuity, understand what that is you get a lifetime check. You know, that spouse gets that money for the rest of their life when you die. And if they die before you, you don't have to pay for it anymore.
Right. So you stop paying the reduction. Yeah, I always think about Uncle Steve, who I mentioned a minute ago, who retired 33 years ago. And over the course of that 33 years, his civil service retirement has more than tripled because it gets cost of living adjustments through the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, and so on.
All the first people are rolling their eyes right now.
Well, they get COLAs, too, just not quite as generous.
right.
There is something.
But anyway.
But so if Uncle Steve were to pass away, he's now 89 and his wife is 83, I think she is. She would receive that survivor annuity based on his current value of his retirement for the rest of her life. She doesn't have to worry about selling a house or moving in with a kid. She would have enough money to keep her lifestyle if she wanted to stay in the same house. Where if he had bought 20-year level term policy when he retired at 55 years old, it would have expired at 75. Mm-hmm. And what would she have now?
And he's buying a flat dollar amount that might have made sense then, but might not make sense later. I mean,
I think in this example, this writer, where him and his wife are both federal retirees, so they're not left destitute if one dies first. That's another consideration. Mm-hmm. Like you said, I think it's a math problem.
It is.
If I die first, what do you need? Mm-hmm. If you die first, what do I need? Mm-hmm. Do I have to sell the house? Do I have to move in with the kids?
Right.
I don't want to do that.
Absolutely.
So that's one that if it was easier, it wouldn't require that kind of thought.
Right.
And unfortunately, some of these things, you really have to individualize them and see how each person's affected. Okay. There was another woman who wrote in, and hers is going to be a little vaguer, but I think it's a question we get a lot. And so let's see how we would address it. Let's see. This is one of the two. She says, I may retire October of 2011. And as a civil service employee, I will have nearly 31 years of service at that point. Oh, this is one about choosing a retirement date. She says, I know your advice would be to leave on October 1st, 2nd, or 3rd to get the earliest possible retirement check. Would your advice change if by staying until October 7th, the end of a pay period, it would add an additional month of sick leave to my service length of service calculation? For personal reasons, I don't want to stay until the end of October. I have run the numbers very carefully, but there is no way that I would have enough sick leave for the extra month unless I stay through the entire pay period that ends on October 7th. Well, this would be a situation, it's a pretty easy one to answer, actually. If you retire under CSRS anywhere past the 3rd of October, you're going to give up the October check. And so for this writer, she says she's got 31 years of service, which means her retirement is over half of her income.
Mm-hmm.
So if her income was, let's say, $5,000 a month, by leaving on October 7th, she's giving up half of that. She's given up her retirement check for that month. So how long would she have to be retired getting that extra month in the calculation, which might only add $7 to $10 a month to her retirement, to give up losing $2,500? I vote for going out no later than October 3rd. Get the October check. If you lose one more month in the calculation, so be it. It's not a big loss to suffer over the long term. You're better off getting continuous compensation, going straight from employment to retirement. And under CSRS, you could stay until October 3rd, pick up a few more days of salary, and then your retirement would start October 4th. By the way, under FERS, you'd want to go out September 30th, because FERS annuities always start the first day of the month.
One comment on that I just want to add that brings to mind. She did say she had personal reasons why she didn't want to stay till the end of October. But one thing I run into as a financial planner very often is people start going, well, you know, if I wait until three more months, then I get even a little more in my annuity. And then, but what if I wait another year?
It's
even more.
Oh, yeah.
And this is where I think financial planning.
I think you should stay 3 years.
I mean, you can keep doing this on and on and on. And I think that one of the biggest things financial planning does is to where you can sit down and realize, well, how long do I need to stay?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then once you stay beyond what you need, the time you need to put in to get the annuity you need and have the assets to be able to afford to retire, all the extra work is doing financially, and it might do other things emotionally, mm-hmm. psychologically,
right.
positive or negative, but all it's doing financially is possibly even building up a nest egg of assets that you may never even use.
Never even need to use.
And I find that kind of disheartening sometimes when you see somebody who's stayed on those 2-3 extra years because they keep wanting to trump up their annuity, and then they pass away a few years into retirement.
Or before.
Or become mm-hmm. ill and think, you know,
yeah.
exactly.
Never really get to enjoy
you know,
it.
I really wish I hadn't stayed those extra couple years. So.
Right. And I guess they have to think, too, what is retirement to me?
Mm-hmm.
Am I really looking forward to not working every day? Do I want to work somewhere else? I think that emotional or that psychological part of planning is probably just as important as the financial sometimes.
Mm-hmm. No question.
And I think that's what prevents people. They think it's about the money. They want to stay and get a little more money. But I think psychologically they're not sure.
What am I going to do?
What am I going to do with those extra 50 hours a week?
Yeah.
that's important. Okay, here's the one I was thinking of that came in. This woman says that she's just joining federal service this month. She got hired, mm-hmm. so they are still hiring. And she said she's 56 years old. I hope to retire from the government when I'm 62. So she plans to work about six years in federal service. Do you have any advice on what I should or shouldn't do regarding health benefits and investments?
First of all, she's going to get her 5 years, right, for her to have health benefits.
Yeah,
which may,
and considering that she's only going to have 6 years of service.
Yeah.
She's going to have lifetime health benefits for her and her husband if they need it.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a good move.
It sounds like she might have just accidentally happened into that.
She timed it perfectly because you need a minimum of 5 years by the time you're 62. She'll have six.
And there really isn't. And I mean, most likely contributing to the TFP makes sense for her just because at this stage she's probably making a good living. You know, mm-hmm. she's working for the government.
Right.
And she can get a tax benefit by contributing to the TSP, but it really is impossible to answer that question any deeper than that without knowing more about her situation.
Well, I thought you would ask that, so I asked her for more information.
Ah.
but here's some of the additional information. I don't know that this is going to help us give her
okay.
any better advice. But she says that, you know, she did work before. She has two 401ks from prior employers that she manages. She has a Roth IRA. She has a regular IRA that's managed by a broker. So she has other retirement savings mm-hmm. going on. Apparently, she didn't say how much, but I would imagine fairly substantial. Mm-hmm. She's 56. She's been investing several years, and like most, she took a hit during the recession. But she's recovering at fairly good speed, which means she didn't put it all in CDs.
Mm-hmm.
She left it, left it in the stock market. She recently got married. Her husband works, and he has a 401k, or a 401k where he works. He's 60 years old, so he's a little bit older than her. He wants to retire at 65, and they'll both have Social Security. I am not sure what type of investments I should get into once employed by the government. Well, luckily, she doesn't have too many choices.
Right. Yeah, there's only five choices.
There's only five to choose from. Perhaps similar to what I'm investing in now, which are mid-caps, income and growth, and bonds. Well, we
okay.
have mid-caps. That would be the S fund, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we have bonds, which would be the F fund. We don't have income and growth.
Yeah, this the only thing is to say mid-caps, income and growth. I mean, mid-caps and bonds are their asset classes, and income and growth is a style of management. So already it sounds a little disjointed. I mean, mm-hmm. I think one of the first things I would do is she said she has a financial advisor is
sit down with him,
throw all this on the table and get the advisor. One thing I think a mistake she may be making here that I see a lot is that advisor, she said, is managing her IRA.
Mm-hmm.
Well, does that advisor know about her 401k and know that she's changed jobs? And is that all incorporated?
Right.
You know, if somebody came to me with a $50,000 IRA and said, what should we invest it in? It's impossible to answer that without knowing how it fits in everything else that she's
doing. What else are you
doing? So, and when she says something like, you know, mid-caps, income and growth and mm-hmm. bonds, it shows me it's not real sure exactly how all this fits together.
Right.
So that would be the biggest thing, either to talk to that advisor or sit down on her own and take inventory of her entire
and knowing that
network.
You have only 5 or 6 more years left that you plan
that's
to work.
That's really important to do.
Yeah, I'd say it's vitally important because you might have to set aside half of that salary to get to that goal if you mm-hmm. really want to retire at 65.
And the other thing is with the money management side is when we joke about, oh, we got mid-caps, we got bonds, is how all these assets work together is vitally important at this age because
mm-hmm.
we want as little risk as possible. When mm-hmm. she says that, you know, oh, it's recovering nicely, it went, that implies that it went way down. you know, it could be that
the
mix might not be right for what she's trying to do. It may be perfect, but it may not be if it hasn't been coordinated across all the different accounts.
Right.
And so that's the big thing. And then what she does in the TSP is going to be of minor consequence because
it's only 5 years.
Exactly. It's a very small amount of money relative to presumably what she's accumulated.
Even if she maxes it out, the most she'll have in there is maybe $100,000, $150,000.
Exactly.
By the time it's all said and done.
So that's a great question, though, to point out how you've got to look at it all in concert with each other.
That's why I thought it'd be worth bringing it up, because I think this is such a common thing. Like, here's what I got, you know, and it doesn't tell you what I have.
And I hear all the time, federal employees tend to be good savers.
Yeah.
I'm going to stereotype them here on the radio.
Yeah.
But what happens is I run into people every day that have all this money in the bank.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, I should do something else with it. It's not earning much. What should I do with it?
Right.
And this is kind of where this question falls. I don't know. It's kind of the tool question again of what is it you're trying to do and how does it fit with your other assets?
Well, the other part of her question had to do with insurance. I'll take this one.
All
it says, my husband has health benefits at no cost to him through his employer, but no vision or dental. When I join the government, I'm considering a high deductible health plan with a health care savings account, which she'll be one of the few people who do that. But I do think they're a good idea. I like HSAs because it's another way to shelter money from taxes and give you freedom to still choose your own doctors. It's a good kind of health insurance. She's trying to learn if I can enroll in a high deductible plan and enroll in a separate dental and vision plan, which you can. You can have, in the federal government, we have something called FedVIP, Federal Employees Dental and Vision Insurance, which is separate from the health benefit program. So you can have a high deductible plan, you can contribute to a health care savings account, and you can have coverage under one of the dental plans or vision plans or both if you want to. I know there are some restrictions on high deductible plans and HSA accounts, but not sure what. Well, that's not one of them. You can have that combination. The only thing she'll have to be careful of is when they qualify for Medicare. If her husband's under Medicare, they can no longer contribute if he's covered under her high deductible health plan, because you can't have contributions to an HSA with other health insurance besides the high deductible plan. But yeah, I'm all for it, that type of combination. Okay, one last email that came in ahead of time, and let's see what we got here. This first question he wrote, and this is Anthony again. He had a lot of good questions, I thought. He said, is there adequate time during the OPM retirement adjudication? In other words, you've retired, OPM is processing your retirement application, and he wants to be able to fund a voluntary contribution account from a lump sum leave check. So he's going to get paid for his unused annual leave. That's going to come from the agency. Generally, it's going to come prior to OPM finishing up the retirement case, and then subsequently roll over the funds to an IRA. Yeah, these days right now, I'd say there's plenty of time, because it's taking OPM right now on average 6 to 8 months to finalize a case.
Mm-hmm.
You're in this what's called interim pay status, so you are getting a check every month, but you're not in full pay status. And during that time, while OPM is adjudicating or finalizing the case, you can set up a voluntary contribution account. You can fund it. When you mail your check in to make your voluntary contributions, you can include the form that would transfer the money to an IRA. So, yeah, I think there is time that you can do that as long as you do it with your retirement application.
Mm-hmm.
I would suggest...
seen them done, I can tell you.
It happens.
We should probably also clarify, this is voluntary contributions for CSRS.
Only.
So the FERS employees aren't going, what's that? What are we talking about?
And even some of the CSRS employees maybe have never heard of it. It's not a real popular, commonly used program, but it's a nice program where employees can contribute after-tax money to the retirement fund. And if you're still working, that money will earn interest at whatever the Civil Service Trust Fund earns, which is currently 2.75%. But this guy, he wants to do it when he retires, mainly as a way to get money from his savings, wherever he has this money, into an IRA.
It's a way to take a large sum of money from savings in a taxable account and put it into possibly even a Roth IRA where it won't be taxed. And, Tammy, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but you've put together something on this, right? Like a document that if people think this might be something that they're interested in. I know, I've sent out what you've put together to people.
Well, it's actually
before.
Bob did it. He put this whole thing together because he's the accountant.
Oh, yeah.
So he's got the tax.
Well, he's not here. I give you the credit.
Okay, I'll take it. I wrote about it, but he actually on NITPINC.com, there's a whole section right on the homepage. It says Roth conversions or voluntary contributions. So I would say follow that guidance, because he's put it together from the tax point of view, from the benefit point of view, and it'll guide you through how to do that. But like you said, and like you've seen it happen, you can do that during the time your retirement's being processed.
Yes.
But it's strictly CSRS. And you're limited. You can put in 10% of your lifetime salary.
It's not really limited, though, when you think about it.
Yeah, who has that laying around?
Yeah.
Right. Where with you're throwing money directly into an IRA, you're limited to, what, $5,000 or $6,000?
Right.
So
right.
This is a way to fund it with much more than just the normal limit.
I mean, very often somebody with 30 years of service, you know, you're talking about several hundred thousand dollars. That they
exactly.
Contribute.
It could be a pretty sizable sum if you have that laying around somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now this other question has to do with moving money from the TSP, you know, I guess after retirement. This is that retirement eligibility with years of contributing to the TSP, and I want to roll over the TSP to an IRA. What are the considerations I should make in trying to do that? You know, how do I move money from the TSP to an IRA? And we're getting close to the end of the show, but I think we can cover that in 2 minutes.
In a nutshell, before you decide to do that, I think you want to weigh, do I want it in an IRA where I could invest it more flexibly and withdraw it more flexibly, but also pay more potentially for it and have more work to do? You know, we talked about earlier, but for some people, the TSP options, it's five choices. I'm not real sure how to handle this one. IRA is
the whole
limitless.
Wall Street Journal.
It's everything. So, you know, in that respect, I think the first decision is to think, if I did move it to an IRA, what would I do with it? Like the woman that asked the prior question who has somebody managing her IRA, call them up and say, you know, if I brought my TSP to you, what would you do with it?
How would you diversify?
Can do a more of a comparison to see performance, risk, fees, you know, how it would benefit you.
And the other advantage, I guess, to moving it to an IRA is that you have the ability to get your hands on it when you need it.
Yes.
Because within the thrift, if you leave, there's nothing wrong, I don't think, with leaving your money in the TSP because, like you said, there's simplicity in having only five choices. It's low cost. But you can only do one partial withdrawal.
Right.
So you can set up a monthly payment stream, but you know, if you want to be able to take it out to put a new roof on the house or take a vacation or remodel the kitchen, you know, you don't have that kind of easy access to it.
And I can tell you, Tammy, the reality with working with a lot of federal retirees is the reality is many of them aren't taking monthly withdrawals out of their IRAs or TSP. They're living off of their annuities. Maybe they have part-time jobs. Maybe other things are going on.
Yeah.
And they just want to use that when they take trips or they just want to use it when they need something larger.
Right. It's the money.
And it doesn't work in the TSP because you can only do it once.
One partial distribution.
Yeah. And the IRA, you can do it however you like.
Well, we are nearing the end of the show already. It was a quick hour. I knew it would be a fun one because you're always fun to talk to and you have good advice. Any final words for people planning their future?
No, I think we've said, I think just in this volatile environment, I think just sitting down and having a plan and knowing where you're headed and make better decisions today, regardless of the volatility and noise we see on the news, to help you be ready when you retire to be able to meet your goals.
Stay calm.
Stay calm through the storm. Don't watch CNBC. Turn off the TV. Listen to Federal News Radio.
There you go. Thanks, Joe. Thanks for being here. I hope you all join us next week when I will be back with James Marshall to talk more about federal benefits. See you next week.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.